Finally, sometimes people ask me if I miss being in television. The truthful answer is sometimes. I do not miss worrying about whether my hair and clothes and makeup are just so at the same time as I'm trying to think of a smart question. I do sometimes miss the power of the camera, being able to show people what they do not want to face. Around here, we like to say that words make the best pictures, but I'm sorry, radio. Sometimes people really need to see things for themselves before they can believe it. And sometimes even then they don't believe it, but at least you've given it your best shot. Hurricane Katrina and its aftermath was an example of that for me. Could anybody really have imagined that their government, their nation, the richest on earth, would allow its citizens to suffer that kind of degradation and negligence if they had not been able to see it with their own eyes? Even now, I find it hard to believe some of the things I saw. And I was there in Houston as the first evacuees arrived from New Orleans, many of them exhausted, dehydrated, and traumatized. Can I just tell you, here's the bigger problem. Many of our most pressing problems are the ones we cannot see, at least right now, no matter how many cameras we have, no matter how hard we try. Or we can't see it unless and until the problem smacks us in our faces, and then it's too late. The federal deficit is that kind of problem. How do you really explain what it will mean if we do not get this problem under control? What do you take a picture of? And it doesn't help that the people who are most vocal about this are people who, frankly, don't give you the impression that they've ever been cold or hungry or frightened in their entire lives. So why, if you think the government should help you with heat or health care or a job, should you listen to them? It also doesn't help that the people who seem to be complaining the loudest about that abstract but very real problem don't seem to have very much to say about the other cancers eating away at our financial viability, which are the corruption and chaos that have become routine in some of our most important financial institutions. The New York Times had a story last month that was an example of that. The paper reported that the credit rating bureaus have a two-tiered system for fixing credit errors, that celebrities, politicians, and other influentials get special help in resolving errors on their credit reports, while everybody else is shunted into an automated system where, and you'll really love this, complaints are then shoveled to a contractor overseas who then spends on average 2 minutes thinking about it and then most times applies a computer code that a creditor may or may not address. Now, it's one thing to get the velvet rope treatment when you're trying to get into a nightclub you don't need to go to for the privilege of paying too much for a cocktail you don't need so you can be ignored by people you shouldn't be going out with anyway. It's quite another matter to be treated like garbage by a group of companies that influence everything from the price you pay for your mortgage or credit card, if you get one, to the job offers you may or may not receive if your credit is bad. The New York Times recounted horror stories of innocent people whose files had been confused with deadbeats or convicted felons, and there was nothing they could do short of going to the courts to fix it, if, of course, they could get somebody to take that case. But here's the obvious issue the Times did not mention. The very fact that such a two-tiered system exists is a powerful indicator that the system doesn't work at all. Because if it did, why would rich and famous people need special advocates? Do famous people get their own traffic lights? No, because when traffic lights work, they work for everybody. And when they don't work, they don't work for anybody. Increasingly, it seems our capital and financial services industries aren't run like traffic lights. They're run like nightclubs for the profit of a few and the convenience of a few while everybody else stands outside in the cold looking foolish. But somehow, we can't see ourselves. Not yet. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
Award-winning writer Ron Hansen is particularly known for his historical novels, such as Marryat in Ecstasy and The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, which was adapted into a film starring Brad Pitt. Hansen's latest novel, A Wild Surge of Guilty Passion, is about an infamous crime of sexual transgression. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Lust makes people do crazy things, as demonstrated by the almost weekly addition of yet another politician to our national walk of shame. But bad as the marital infidelities and lewd twitterings of our elected officials may be, there's cold comfort to be found in the fact that none of them have gone completely over the edge. In fact, if I had any pity for Schwarzenegger, Edwards, Wiener, and company, I'd recommend that, in their exile, they might want to read Ron Hansen's new novel about the real-life Ruth Snyder murder case, just to see how much worse things can get when the libido goes homicidally haywire. Hansen's latest is called A Wild Surge of Guilty Passion, and its story weds two of his fascinations as a novelist, the strange mutations of desire, which he explored in Mariette in Ecstasy, and the inner life of outlaws, most notably Jesse James. As its overheated title suggests, A Wild Surge of Guilty Passion delves deep into the hormonally saturated psyches of two people driven by desire to commit what was called in 1927 the crime of the century. In Hansen's version of the tale, Queens housewife and mother Ruth Snyder was a voluptuous Jean Harlow blonde, antsy to escape a flat marriage. On a shopping trip into Manhattan, Ruth meets a traveling lingerie salesman named Judd Gray. Despite his racy job, the married Judd is rather repressed. That is, until Ruth introduces him to the romping delights of sin. For months, they sneak away for trysts in the Waldorf Astoria and to less elegant hotels in places like Buffalo and Scranton along Judd's sales route. But Ruth wants more. She wants hubby Al to do the 23 skidoo permanently. After taking out extra life insurance on the unsuspecting Al, Ruth makes a number of almost vaudevillian attempts to kill him by gas and poison. Nothing works until the night that Judd garrots Al with wire. Ruth tells the police that a couple of giant Italian burglars were the culprits, but that story is as flimsy as the lingerie Judd peddles. Soon, the two are on trial for murder, and the 11 newspapers then in circulation in New York City have a ball relaying all the salacious details about the Viking vampire, as they called the Nordic Ruth, and her stooge of a sex-addled boyfriend. If this all sounds a bit familiar, blame James M. Cain, who mined the Snyder case for both Double Indemnity and The Postman Always Rings Twice. Given Cain's classic novels, the immortal films noir that were made from them, and the many other books, including Snyder's and Gray's own jailhouse memoirs that have been written about this quintessential tawdry tabloid crime, the question arises: do we really need Hansen's novel? I'd vote yes, with qualifications. If I had to put only one creative retelling of the Snyder case in a time capsule, it would be Billy Wilder's Double Indemnity. Barbara Stanwyck defines femme fatale in that movie. What A Wild Surge of Guilty Passion contributes to the Snyder canon is, first of all, a deliciously tangible appreciation of how the giddy sexual and commercial spirit of the Roaring Twenties were linked. Hansen delights in festooning his novel with all manner of period places and products, which somehow heighten the 20s devil-may-care social mores, hosiery shops and riotous smorgasbord restaurants, Wrigley chewing gum, Helena Rubinstein lipsticks, and Mavis talcum powder. Even more dazzling is Hansen's rendering of Judd's besottedness with Ruth. I can't quote the relevant carnal passages on the radio, but they sizzle. Even as he knows he's being played, Judd is too weak in the knees to ever attempt the return trip back to wife and family. Hansen follows the story to its fated conclusion, the 1928 death by electrocution of Judd and Ruth for the murder of her husband. Tabloid photographs of Ruth Snyder, most of them taken during her imprisonment, don't show her to be the knockout or wowser she was supposed to be. Hansen's account remedies that, however, by conjuring up Ruth's dark eroticism and the way it whispered to a man that sex was worth any sacrifice.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed A Wild Surge of Guilty Passion by Ron Hansen. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
President Obama's push to get the economy moving has run into significant roadblocks in the Senate. That chamber is still controlled by the president's fellow Democrats. But simply by threatening a filibuster, Senate Republicans can block presidential nominees for key economic posts. And as NPR's David Wellner reports, that is exactly what they have done.
In early March, President Obama announced he was nominating Commerce Secretary Gary Locke to be the next U.S. ambassador to China. Days later, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell convened a news conference at the Capitol.
I'm here today to announce that we have got 44 signatures on a letter to the president indicating that we don't intend to move forward on the nomination of a new Secretary of Commerce or any other trade-related position that requires confirmation of the Senate.
McConnell said Republicans would block such nominations until the White House submitted to Congress three pending trade agreements with Panama, Colombia, and South Korea. Those trade agreements remain stalled over GOP objections to training for displaced workers. Republicans reacted angrily when President Obama nominated John Bryson, former energy executive and co-founder of the Natural Resources Defense Council, to be the next Commerce Secretary.
Instead of appointing a truly an economic leader, he has appointed an environmental extremist.
That's Wyoming Senator John Barrasso. He says the president's pick to head commerce would make it harder and more expensive for the private sector to create jobs.
So the president might think he's the right man at the right time. I think he is the wrong man at the worst time.
At least half a dozen other nominees for senior economic policy positions have been stalled for weeks and sometimes months in the Senate. Majority Leader Harry Reid last week accused Republicans of bottling up those nominations in a bid to limit President Obama to a single term in office.
Even someone that won a Nobel Prize for economics wasn't good enough to be on the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System, according to the Republicans.
That would be MIT professor Peter Diamond, who was awarded the Nobel Prize last year for his work on joblessness. More than a year after being nominated for a vacant seat on the Fed, Diamond last week withdrew his nomination. Alabama Republican Senator Richard Shelby led the effort to keep Diamond off the Fed.
A lot of people had a lot of questions, not just me, about his, although he's a smart man, he's a Nobel Prize winner, look what he was in. Look behind into the weeds. He supported all the printing of money, borrowing money, stimulus stuff. He would just be ratifying what the Obama administration's doing through the Fed.
Shelby said he did not want someone on the Fed who advocated government intervention to fight unemployment. Michael Barr served the first 2 years of the Obama administration as Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Financial Institutions. Barr points out the Fed is, in fact, congressionally mandated to try to spur job growth.
Peter Diamond is squarely in the mainstream of academic thought in this area, and I think he would have been an exceptionally strong Federal Reserve member helping the Fed to guide monetary policies.
Meanwhile, pressure is growing from outside groups for President Obama to appoint Harvard Law professor Elizabeth Warren as head of the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, to which Senator Shelby says,
"Absolutely not. Absolutely not."
Shelby and 43 other Republican senators have all signed a letter saying they will block anyone named to head that bureau until it's restructured to their liking. David Wellner, NPR News, The Capitol.
Father's Day is this Sunday, and Tell Me More is celebrating dads all week. We've asked some of our contributors and guests of the program to reflect on the joys and challenges of fatherhood. We'll hear from a guy many regard as the conventional married dad. We'll hear from the dad going it alone, the one who chose to adopt, and others. Starting us off is Lester Spence, an assistant professor of political science and Africana studies at Johns Hopkins University. He's a frequent contributor to our barbershop segment.
My wife and I are parents to five children, three boys, two girls, no twins. My 16-year-old daughter is a writer, carries herself with the grace of a dancer, and is so down to earth that she makes her own natural hair products. My 13-year-old son, quiet and reserved. He only shares himself with people he's already vetted. My 11-year-old, he's the most empathetic out of the group. He created a gang at school, the Friendly Five, to peacefully resolve conflicts between his classmates. He still hugs me every night before he goes to bed. My 8-year-old daughter is the artist. Absolutely loves to draw, to paint, to sketch, to create things with her hands. And my 6-year-old, he's absolutely hilarious, sings at the top of his voice, off key, and dances at the drop of a hat. His preschool teacher called him Mr. Shaky Hips. The squad has changed my life irrevocably. I didn't know what unconditional love was before they were born. To the extent that I consider myself a good man, it is because I am a father. But even as I have been blessed by my children, even as I take a great deal of pride in their accomplishments, even as I take a great deal of pride in my own given who they are, and despite moments of joy, my role as father produces more anxiety than any other role I have. As the sole breadwinner, I'm responsible for whether my five children have a roof over their head, whether they have food to eat. I'm responsible for their safety, for their security. I'm responsible for whether they're able to go to college without the burden of loans. If I don't produce, if for some reason I end up unemployed, if for some reason I fail, then the lives of those five children change for the worse. For a number of reasons, we don't really talk about this obligation unless we're talking about people who aren't fulfilling it. We can talk for hours about absent fathers, about how irresponsible they are, about how much damage they're doing to their kids, but we don't spend the same amount of time talking about what fathers really need to fulfill their obligation. On Father's Day, I don't ask for or expect any gifts as a general rule. Maybe I should expect gifts from my family. Maybe I should expect gratitude for waking up every day around 5 a.m. to be the first in the office so I can come home to them about 6. But what I would really like for Father's Day is peace of mind, knowing I can fulfill my obligations.
That was Lester Spence, a married father of five, an assistant professor of political science and Africana studies at Johns Hopkins University, and a regular contributor to The Barbershop.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. A troubled year at Central Falls High School in Rhode Island is coming to an end. Central Falls is considered one of the worst schools in the state, and it drew national attention last year when administrators threatened to fire all of the teachers. They dropped the proposal when teachers agreed to a so-called transformation plan. But now, as NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports, that plan is a shambles.
Since August, when the restructuring of Central Falls High School began, 26 teachers have resigned or been fired. Josh Carton is one of them.
I think I've been let go because I'm not a true believer.
Carton, a history and business teacher for 4 years here, says he was all for the school's transformation, which called for a much tougher teacher evaluation policy, mandatory training, and more time dedicated to struggling students. The plan and the money to pay for it came from the Obama administration's campaign to fix schools labeled dropout factories. Carton's enthusiasm, though, took a dive after he was put in charge of the restoration room, what he calls a holding pen for the school's most disruptive students.
But then once I started questioning some of the things they were doing, you know, putting the kids in a room just to get them out of the way for the period and then putting them back out, and then they basically just kept telling me to shut my mouth and just log people when they come in. I never got to teach.
Carton says the school was in such disarray, in-school suspensions jumped from 2,300 to 8,500 by the end of May. His contract was not renewed because he says he had seen too much and refused to be muzzled. Not true, says Superintendent Frances Gallo, although she declined to discuss Carton's firing.
personnel matters are personnel matters, but shame on us if we didn't have enough planning with Josh so that he understood the role and knew what had to be done.
The debacle at Central Falls High has gotten national attention because President Obama and his Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, have publicly sided with administrators, arguing that teachers must be held accountable for students' dismal test scores. Last year, only 7% of students tested at grade level in math, 24% in reading. This year's test results could be worse. Why?
Because of our low expectations in the classroom. Meaning teachers, yes.
Superintendent Gallo believes some teachers have sabotaged her reforms. Teachers say those reforms are a joke. Joe Travers, a 21-year veteran, was transferred to an elementary school after saying so at a town hall meeting.
I'm fighting this because what they did is wrong. They used the word transformation as a buzzword for everything. We can do this because of transformation. But transformation tries to retain the teachers that are doing a good job, tries to retain the teachers that can move the school forward.
Instead, says Travers, the absolute lack of trust in Gallo and administrators has made it impossible to move forward. Rhode Island's Education Commissioner Deborah Gist agrees.
If people are not working together, are not communicating, there is no chance for its success.
With teachers and administrators at an impasse, GIS, too, has come under fire for failing to bring both sides together.
I am ultimately responsible for getting that done.
GIS says the school could eventually be shut down or turned into a charter school. State legislators are calling for an investigation. How the $1 million in federal funds for the school's transformation have been spent, and whether the school district violated the due process rights of teachers. No one has been hurt more by the upheaval at Central Falls High than this year's seniors. A few stand outside the school signing yearbooks, laughing at a page titled 111 Things to Remember.
My favorite one is, please excuse the interruption. We need coverage for periods 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. Thank you. And teachers getting fired, rehired, then fired again.
Ashley Castro and Derek Lopez say this is not how they wanted to remember their senior year.
I think most of us do feel cheated. I mean, like for the 4 years, every year has been different. And this year has by far been the worst.
Like, they kind of let all the bad kids do whatever they want. It's just kind of pathetic.
And so, as the Obama administration considers how to turn failing schools around, Central Falls High has become a cautionary tale about the complexities of school reform and whether the federal government should be dictating what those reforms should be. Claudia Sanchez, NPR News.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
I'm Melissa Block, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. Imagine if you could use your cell phone or send an email from anywhere. Well, one company is working hard to make out of range a thing of the past, providing internet access with satellites and a network of 40,000 antennas. But GPS advocates say the new service would interfere with their devices. As NPR's Brian Naylor reports, they worry the service could make it harder for first responders to find emergencies, for aviators to fly, and for drivers to navigate.
Continue 0.1 miles, then turn right on Pennsylvania Avenue Northwest.
The GPS device has become ubiquitous. Millions of drivers rely on them for directions. GPS navigation is the basis for a new air traffic control system the government plans to build. It's also an important tool in agriculture. Rick Richter is owner of Richter Aviation in Maxwell, California, flying what used to be known as crop dusters. He uses GPS every day.
It provides our swath guidance to within 1 meter accuracy of where we would like to put the chemicals or the crop protection products or the seeds or fertilizers. So it allows for precise application of our products.
Richter is president of the National Agricultural Aviation Association. It's one of several groups that want to put the brakes on construction of a new broadband service by a company called LightSquared. In a video on its website, LightSquared offers an enticing vision.
Wireless devices will work in every single part of the country. People will be able to send email from the Grand Canyon. Download a full-length movie in mere minutes while on the move. make a phone call far away from anywhere's bill.
The problem, says Richter, the radio signals the broadband carrier wants to use for its wireless network interfere with signals used by GPS.
There's no doubt there's going to be interference. You can almost guarantee that because that signal is so much more powerful than a GPS signal.
In fact, the government's own tests have shown the light squared signals cause some GPS receivers to lose strength and they block out others entirely. This has caused both the Defense Department and the Department of Homeland Security to raise questions. That's because the part of the radio spectrum which the FCC granted to light squared is right next door to the part of the spectrum used by GPS. Communications consultant Scott Cleland says it's a bit like a zoning dispute,
where people that already have houses or they already have buildings, and somebody comes along next to them and wants to build a skyscraper or wants to build something that has a very different use than what they had before. And so what this is like a giant spectrum zoning spat.
Light Squared, the new guy in the neighborhood, has already invested billions of dollars in its network. Based on the FCC's go-ahead, it launched a 7-story-tall satellite last November and plans to build some 40,000 ground transmitters. Company Vice President Jeff Carlisle is confident the two sides can work something out.
We still want to make sure that we're deploying our network responsibly. And that requires us to sit down cooperatively and talk with the GPS folks and figure out the most efficient and fair way to do it. If that requires some filtering on their side and some transmission modifications on ours, we're open to talking about that. Absolutely.
One possible solution would be for Light Squared to use the part of the spectrum they've been allocated that's farthest from the part GPS receivers use. The company had hoped to roll out its network later this year, but facing concerns from government agencies and competing businesses, it's clear they've got some obstacles to navigate around first. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Washington.